Yes, sir. Senator Bob, my name is Rabbi David Glanz from Crane, and I'm a resident of Memorial Park, and I wanted to say, first of all, given your busy schedule, given what's happening on tonight, I want to thank you for your service. To be with us this morning. I just would like, if you would, to comment. You said that you did not agree with President Carter's decision to meet with members of Hamas this week. And at the same time, you said that, like the president, you would pursue aggressive diplomacy with Iran. Could you help articulate why you would not support President Carter's decision to speak to Hamas, but at the same time, you would aggressively pursue diplomacy in Iran?
Well, Hamas is not a state. Hamas is a terrorist organization. They have obviously great influence within the Palestinian territories, but they do not control the apparatus of power. They are not legitimately recognized as a state. They don't have a seat in the United Nations. And so I think there's a very clear distinction, not necessarily in terms of some of the organized government that comes out of Iran's leadership versus Hamas's leadership, but there's a distinction in terms of their status in the international community. My interest in meeting with Iran is practical. It's not based on my assessment of who they are or my judgment of their values, but rather as a practical assessment in terms of how we can best achieve our ultimate goal, which is an Iran that is not threatening its neighbors, is not threatening Israel, is not possessing nuclear weapons, is not funding organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas. And so that sets aside. That in the same way that I do North Korea, in the same way that I do Syria, in the same way that historically presidents like FDR do Stalin or Kennedy do Khrushchev or Nixon do Mao or Reagan do Bush, I believe, benefit in terms of legitimacy around the world if we say we are willing to talk directly. Not because we approve of these states, but because it shows that we are willing to listen. By doing so, I think we actually further isolate Iran as opposed to strengthening. I know if there's an argument about what kind of propaganda group it would be for Iran. I actually think that the propaganda group for Iran has been this sense of being in battle and attacked. As a consequence, it gives an excuse for countries like China or countries like Russia to sit on the sidelines, not engage in kinds of aggressive pressure that is needed for them to step down on their nuclear program. Frankly, the unilateral approach that President Bush has taken, the manner in which has not only strengthened Iraq strategically, but they've been, as I said, the biggest beneficiary of the war in Iraq. But it's also given Iran an excuse not to engage the international community and to suggest that, well, we're just the victims of a scheme on the part of the United States to execute regime change throughout the Middle East. That, I think, is a mistake. Now, let me be very clear about what I mean when I say direct talks. What it means is that we come to the table with a very clear set of objectives, a very clear set of demands. That Iran ceases from pursuing nuclear weapons, that it stops funding Hezbollah and Hamas, that it ends its noxious statements about Israel and the threats directed towards Israel. They may not agree to any one or all of those demands, but by having made them direct, it becomes much more difficult for them, I think, to posture on the international stage, and then positions us to be able to obtain the kinds of assistance from potential allies.
What's the position on the center? I have a question that first of all was like 40 years ago. I was a member of the D.C. delegation to the famous, infamous Democratic Convention in Chicago. We were pledged to Bobby Kennedy until he was murdered. And then we nominated the chair of our delegation, a young minister committed to nonviolence and to opposing the Vietnam War. His name was Channing Phillips. He was black. He was the first person, the first African-American ever nominated for president on the floor of any major convention. In that sense, I think we opened the door that I hope I will be able to walk through. So the question I have is this. I appreciate what you said here and what you said in the Cleveland meeting with Jewish leadership of the nuances of policy necessary in the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. What I haven't heard, and I know hundreds of rabbis and hundreds of thousands of Jews would like to hear, is some sense that you understand that there are also some actions by the Israeli government, notably its settlement policy, its refusal to even saying over and over again to withdraw settlements and some, but its refusal to actually do that, that also contribute, maybe not the most important contribution, but an important contribution to the inability to achieve peace. I wonder what, as president, how you would feel and what you would think and what you would do about that.
There is no doubt that the situation now is complex. And one of the things that I loved about visiting Israel was to see Israelis argue among themselves. Right? There's just a healthy debate that takes place that sometimes is not as open here in the United States, which is understandable. When you're in your own family, you feel like you can argue a lot more than you can outside the family. But I think the majority of Israelis recognize that for peace to move forward, there's going to have to be a shift in settlement policy. I don't think that in and of itself is controversial. My instinct is, and probably the reason that I don't focus on it as much in my discussions, is that it's very hard to move that discussion forward if you feel as if there's no partner on the other side to actually enforce and deliver on an agreement. And so, in discussions that I've had with Israelis, both in government and outside of government, I think there's an understanding that there's going to have to be movement on both sides. That if we're going to achieve a two-state solution, that the Palestinians are going to have to recognize that the right of return, as they've understood it historically, would extinguish Israel as a Jewish state, and that's not an option. And that conversely, Israelis are going to have to create concede enough territorially that you've got a coherent Palestinian state. Not one that is just a state in name, but one that is functional and works. And I believe that Israelis will be prepared to make, but there will undoubtedly be some wrenching political decisions along those lines. But my sense is right now that until you get some apparatus, some mechanism for Palestinian territories or authority that gives Israelis confidence that somebody can make a deal and then actually follow through on the deal, then they'd rather not have to go through what will be a great deal of political discussion. And I understand that. I think there's got to be a process of real negotiations before you get a full public area of how to deal with the settlement.
Yes, please. Richard Berkman from Shaw, United States. As a follow-up, if your aggressive diplomacy doesn't work anymore, and you believe that they are actually on the verge of acquiring nuclear weapons, Did your option of keeping all options open mean you would use military force to prevent the incoming of nuclear weapons from that power, or would you rather live with this?
This is a question that I think has been posed repeatedly during, of course, the presidential campaign. And I think wisely, all of us, at least on the Democratic side, but I also think the wiser gets on the Republican side, have not engaged in hypotheticals about what particular actions we would take. What I will say is that I will do everything I can to prevent that particular action. And what I've also said is that I will leave all military actions on the table, not in achieving that.
Senator Obama, Samuel Donskin, a volunteer, proudly representing the Great Britain Building International. Follow up to the gentleman's question about peace. What is your position in reference to Jerusalem on the table, which is a really big concern with regards now that they have the Arab community has changed their access to Israel in a sense that they're more concerned about the border since 1967. And to achieve any peace, I don't think I'd like to see Israel give up a good chunk of Jerusalem.
Well, I believe that this is a decision that has to be made by the parties, not by the United States. But let's be clear, Israel, I think, has a historic claim on Jerusalem. I think that obviously there are sacred sites in the old city that are central to not just Judaism, but also to Islam and Christianity. I think it's very important for us to find a way in which all those claims are respected. And you know, this is something that I think is very important for the parties themselves to decide. I believe that it is not an acceptable option for Jerusalem to be settled in Israel along the lines of the 1967. That is not going to be an option. Yes, I'm going to get the moment here to see that.
My name is Paula Johnson. I am the chair of the Greater Philadelphia Leadership Group. You talk a lot about the United States' position in the local community, what we need to do to restore ourselves to that position of beloved international leaders. We hold a permanent place in the United Nations by that more anti-Israel resolutions than any other country. Would you instruct us, President, your ambassador to the United Nations to continue to veto those resolutions?
Absolutely. That's unfortunate. Part of the task, I think, of the United States, and part of a leadership I think I can provide is I think I can be a powerful voice on the world stage in saying, let's stop with the nonsense with respect to that is precisely because for a variety of reasons will be somewhat unique as president. not just in terms of being the first African American president, but also being somebody who's been raised overseas, who has family who lives overseas, who has lived across the country for a child for a time, who has family in Africa. I think for me to speak to the General Assembly and lift up the hypocrisy that's been operating within the United Nations for so long that targets Israel for constant harassment, oftentimes led by regimes that have no observance of human rights and no regard for their own people. I think that kind of one thought is something that I can deliver with more credibility than maybe some other presidents might. And I think that's important to do. And my argument to the world community would be this is counterproductive. It is not advancing the interests of those countries. It has become just sort of a movement. People who go through the motions of, let's vote against Israel periodically as a way to distract from solving real problems. And my ability to deliver that message is that I'm not somebody who is anti-United Nations. I actually believe in the United Nations as a potential for resolving disputes and for having violence. And precisely because, despite my criticisms of the United Nations functions, I believe in it as an institution and the possibilities for doing good, I think I can be an honest critic. In the same way that, for example, when I went to my father's home country in Kenya, I delivered a major address saying, yes, the United States and other countries need to do more to help poor countries, but poor countries have to do more for themselves in rooting out corruption, establishing rule of law. That kind of proof element, I think, is just by law. Okay, make sure I'm not neglecting this cycle. Yes.
Thank you for meeting with us, Senator. I'm Nancy Gordon, Jack Pack, Philadelphia Chair from your home state. I have a question about your interaction with your former pastor, but I think it's one at least I haven't heard an answer to. After you became aware of his inflammatory remarks, did you ever discuss them with him, the tone and the content? And if so, can you tell us what you said and whether your comments had any effect?
Well, I would be honest with you. I did not become aware of them until I started running for president. And at that point, yes, I had conversations with him, which I shared with him my deep concern. Now, I have to say, and I said this before, that the caricature that's been presented to him, I think, is not an accurate depiction of who he is as a pastor. And I also want to note, I think, this notion that's always been put forward that he is my spiritual advisor. He was my pastor, which meant that when I went to church, he was in the service. Many of them incitement and powerful in speaking about justice and the social gospel. The sermons that were the source of controversy and were deeply disturbing to me, and I did address them. I did tell him that I found them disturbing and wrong. As I mentioned, he was also at that point several months away from retirement. And so you make a decision about how are you going to handle it. Do you publicly announce his comments? Do you privately express concerns with them, but recognize that you're still part of a broader church community that is going to be transitioning? I chose the latter. I think it's very important to understand that my values and ideals with respect to both the United States, with respect to my foreign policy, with respect to Israel, nobody's actually questioned my, or nobody can find anything in my behavior or writings that is anything other than unequivocally supportive of